you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you...
Priscilla Warner with us. She's the author of Learning to Breathe, My Year-Long Quest to Become Calm, the quest to bring calm to my life. She grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, raised her two sons with her husband in Westchester County, New York. And after working for many years as an advertising art director, she co-authored the New York Times bestseller, The Faith Club, and spent 3 years promoting the book while engaging in interfaith dialogue all across America. She's appeared on such national media quests as the outlets as the Today Show, CBS Sunday Morning, CNN, NPR, and writes for More Magazine and the Huffington Post, among others. Priscilla, hi, welcome to the show. Hi, Priscilla.
Hi.
Oh, good.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. You know, as a matter of fact, did you hear the intro? For some reason, I think we might have been
I did, yeah.
Oh, good.
I heard all of those things about me, yes.
Yes, and in your spare time, what do you do? I bet that keeps you
I meditate.
Hey, by the way, I want to get into that because I think it's extremely important. Learning to breathe is really about you handling panic attacks. And I would believe, and I'm not a clinician, but I would believe more people have panic attacks than we hear about because it can come in many, many different degrees. So let's start out with the definition and say, what is a panic attack? And then following it with, when did you realize that you really had the problem?
Well, 6 million people, 6 million Americans actually, suffer from panic attacks. About 40 million people have anxiety disorders, and panic attacks are a type of an anxiety disorder. Basically, I would say, how would I describe a panic attack? You would really know it if you were having it, although actually lately people have been telling me that they don't necessarily know exactly what's happening to them. The variety of symptoms that are really awful, if you look it up in the diagnostic manual for a therapist, it's the feeling of choking, you can't breathe, your head is spinning, nausea, shakes, flushes. It's really unpleasant. You feel like you're having a heart attack. I did anyway. I had my first panic attack when I was 15 years old, back when nobody was using the word panic attack. So I really didn't know what was happening to me on that otherwise normal day. I was a waitress at a cafeteria, and all of a sudden this came over me, and I really felt like I was dying.
Well,
and
then
I continued
really
to have these panic attacks for the next 40 years. And I managed them. I took anti-anxiety medication. I went to see a therapist. And, you know, I've managed to build a life for myself. I was in advertising for many years, as you said earlier, which isn't probably the best place to be when you have an anxiety disorder. But, you know, many people cope with this. And many people, it's kind of a shameful experience for many people. I felt that way anyway, which is, I thought I was some sort of freak. I just didn't understand why my central nervous system seemed to be more delicate and out of balance than everybody else's.
Now, by the way, is it a fear of loss of control? Is that what it is? You just lose control? You can't grasp the reality of what's going on in life at the moment?
That's definitely part of it. You feel like your body is out of control and you can't self-regulate. So somebody, a wonderful woman who I talk about and visit with in my book, named Belarus Napersteck, who does guided imagery. And it's a sort of a type of, she leads you through a meditation. She says when you don't have the oomph to do mindfulness meditation yourself. And she works with incredible, she troops in Afghanistan and Iraq download her guided imagery onto their iPods or phones, actually, for She works with people with post-traumatic stress. But she described it to me, panic is actually a very simple thing, which is really an overactive survival response. So, you know, you hear about the fight or flight response in your brain. Your brain gets sort of overactivated. And, for example, I mean, I felt like I couldn't breathe, but in fact I was breathing too much. So when you see people breathing into a brown paper bag or, you know, that's kind of, maybe you've seen it in movies, that is because sure. you're actually taking in too much air, and when you breathe into a paper bag, it counteracts that effect. But it's really unpleasant.
No, and I can imagine what it occurs. When you mentioned fight or flight syndrome, that you know, there's two responses to that. You've got the sympathetic and then the parasympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system, you know, kicks out the adrenaline, gets you ready for action. And what the sympathetic nervous system does, it calms you down. Homeostasis
exactly.
balances you out. So from what you're saying and what I'm hearing, and please stop me if I'm wrong, that you get that sympathetic nervous system kicking in and nothing's compensating for it and there's no control over
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, imagine for people who don't have this, if you've had, you know, 20 cups of coffee and, you know, something can trigger you and you'll have an out of control response or a response that would be sort of abnormal for you under normal circumstances. It's, I guess, for somebody who hasn't had panic, that's the only way I could describe it.
Sure. So in essence, what we're saying that this is this can be, or from maybe it is, a neurological problem.
Well, what happens is your brain gets sort of wired to anticipate this kind of these sensations flooding your central nervous system. And for me, because I'd had so many panic attacks, these traumatic memories get lodged in your limbic system in the most primitive part of your brain so that you're kind of constantly in combat mode where you think that something's going to happen and you're anticipating it and your whole central nervous system is on wire, you know, on guard, ready for that.
Sure. That's the emotional part of your brain. Yeah. That's the emotional part of your brain that's the decision-making that decision-making area also. And when you're dealing with emotions, emotions are what causes you to make any kind of a decision in your life, good, bad, or indifferent, fear of loss, desire for gain, etc., you know, which is going to be the more prevalent for you, the more emotionally satisfying for you, you make that decision. But what I'm hearing you say, that it has to do with brain chemistry. And it's an out of control facet of the inner working of your brain that causes the panic attack. Now, how do you, besides meditation, because that will calm it down, through imagery causes a chemical reaction. So besides imagery, what else will do it?
Well, I have to say all of the terms that we're talking about are things that I barely knew what my amygdala was, which is the area of your brain where the fight or flight response, you know, takes place. So for me, the book is not, I mean, I get into some of this in the book, but a therapist said to me early on, panic disorder is a syndrome, and so you have to understand panic in you. It comes from a variety of factors, psychological, physiological, and environmental. And so what happened for me is that I decided, I had read about these monks, Tibetan monks, who'd been meditating so effectively that their prefrontal cortex was lit up on MRIs. And I was sitting on a plane in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was in the middle of a book tour, and I opened up a magazine. I read yet another story about these monks, and I said, you know what, I want the brain of a monk, and I want everything that goes along with that brain, like peace and tranquility and loving kindness and compassion, and I'm going to learn how to meditate, and I'm going to see if I can meditate my way from panic to peace. And I came home, I wrote a book proposal, I sold it to my publisher, and I kind of knew that I had a plan, which was to be monk-like, but, you know, still driving around in my minivan in the suburbs. So I researched various meditation teachers, and I started off with a Tibetan monk who had panic attacks as a child, and he's a fantastic meditation teacher, particularly for beginners, because he's very open-minded with the way that he approaches things. And I went from him, I studied with several, I chose Western Buddhist teachers who spoke to me the most for various reasons, and they're all in my book. They all have websites, and they're on my website, and so they're a wonderful resource. There's also free downloads that you can find online of their teachings, and they can lead you through meditation. But in addition to that, once I started to sit and be able to calm myself down through meditation, I found some terrific therapies which are extremely helpful to me. One of them is called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's a type of therapy where you can do it with lights, flashing lights, you can do it with sounds, and you can do it through touch. But I did it with the lights. And what that does, you watch this panel of flashing lights, and it bilaterally stimulates the left and right sides of your brain. So when you experience emotional things, you experience them on the right side of your brain. And sometimes traumatic memories get frozen in that right side of your brain. And what this bilateral stimulation does is it helps you. Usually you would process those memories and they would get categorized on the left side of your brain. And this bilateral stimulation facilitates that process. So as I describe it in the book, the memories that I had sort of repressed or suppressed or, you know, the things that I wasn't able to access sure. because they were too traumatic came sort of floating up to the surface, but not in a violent way, in a way that was sort of organic. Your body, your brain goes where it wants to heal, which is what I was told by this therapist. So I did that. I did something else called somatic experience therapy, actually before that, because it's a little less challenging, at least it was for me. And that's where this is a body-based therapy. Some of these therapies are developed by people. Seems to me like a West Coast, some of these therapies were developed by people. This particular one was by Peter Levine in Denver. And what you do is you ground yourself. You learn how to ground yourself. You're sitting on a couch in a therapist's office. And then you pendulate. You put 90% of your attention where you're grounded. You think of the fearful things that are setting off your panic. And you put 10% of your energy there. And you feel the release of these traumatic sensations in your body. But very slowly, and it's kind of like burning it off. I can't explain it anyway. It's sort of burning off this nervous energy, and you pendulate back and forth between a fearful place and a grounded place. And these are the kinds of therapies that are used, you know, really sort of routinely by therapists who do post-traumatic stress work. And the third one was something called Traeger therapy, which is a light touch therapy developed by this very interesting man named Milton Traeger, who used to do acrobatics on the beach in Miami Beach and discovered that he had this power to heal people. And there were just some really interesting, I say I fell down these rabbit holes, and I met the most interesting people, and they really taught me that there are many ways to heal, and there are some profoundly impressive, some of them subtle, and some of the very dramatic techniques out there that people have been using for a long time, but I was never aware of.
All to bring you to a point whereby to neutralize what part of that system in it's in your body that creates when you go through that fight or flight syndrome. What that is, it's a primitive state, and it goes all the way back to protecting right. yourself. And if something happens where you feel threatened in any way, shape, or form, you're either going to stand up and fight, lay down and play dead till the danger's over, or go run away. And you've got those things that you're looking at.
Right. Actually, this wonderful meditation teacher, Tara Brock, said, if our ancestors had spent all their time just sunning themselves on rocks, you know, we wouldn't be here today. So this system was in place to help us survive. But as Bell Ruth Napperstack said to me, I mentioned earlier, she said it's basically an overactive survival response that, you know, in the 21st century, there's a lot to be anxious about. And you don't have to have a panic disorder in order to feel out of control and, you know, anxious these days.
By the way, Priscilla, it can happen. We're starting to run out of time now. But it can happen as fast as you walk into a room, I'm standing in the room, and I happen to look like somebody that you might have known at one time that has caused a problem in your life. For that very split second, that millisecond with that shot of adrenaline that happens to protect yourself, and that's that system that you're talking about now, and it can happen that simple. You get over it and you walk away because it's not something that's going to cause any major problems in your life. But that system that you're talking about, to the degree that you're talking about it, obviously that's going to cause a problem. But that happens when you look at somebody and they remind you of somebody that you don't like, that system comes into play.
Well, you know, for flashbacks for Vietnam, for veterans of war and stuff, I'm sure there are many, that happens to them all the time. I have to say, for me, because of my meditation practice, I'm able to calm myself down and to ground myself at any moment, wherever I am. I can pull over in my car and meditate now. So I have access to a place that is very calm and safe and grounded now. And I really have rewired my brain. That's what happens, is you can literally, you know, neuroplasticity means that your brain can change at any age, I'm happy to say. And I feel like the chemistry of my brain is completely different than it was. I was also part of a study at the University of Pennsylvania where a neuroscientist actually scanned my brain, and I meditated for 8 weeks, and he scanned it again, and you could see the changes taking place. He says that meditation is like lifting weights for your brain. That eventually everybody, the way people are supposed to exercise 20, 30 minutes a day, they should be meditating 20 minutes a day.
All right, now we're just about out of time. Now, you had mentioned before there were downloads on your website. Your website, where do we find you?
PriscillaWarnerBooks.com.
Okay, that was easy enough. Go ahead.
And I have a resources page there with all of the teachers who I studied with and the healers and the different therapies and techniques and organizations. And in my book, I have a resource section in the back. And I have what I call Priscilla's Plan, which is, you know, my little tidbits of information. Everybody now asks me, can you teach me to meditate? You know, my friends are very stressed out, and they want me to teach them in that moment. So I have a plan.
Wonderful. Hey, Priscilla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Mountains and jungles and desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those.
Michelle Ricklin back with us, holding a BA in theater, English literature, speech communication, all from Hofstra University. Also beginning her corporate career, she pursued and completed an MA in Speech and Interpersonal Communication from New York University, where she also served as an instructor in voice diction, and public speaking. And let us say, Michelle, hi, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I can't wait for this one. Let's talk about the Pac-Man method for job seekers. Don't get eaten alive.
Well, I figured for our audience today, I'd like to come up with something a little fun, because the job seeking process can be a little daunting.
Sure.
So something a little fun that people can remember and use in order to get their job search kick-started. So I came up with the Pac-Man method for job seekers, and it's all about not getting eaten alive in that very, very competitive game that we call the job search. So starting off with our P, preparing your personal inventory. And what I like to tell my clients is the first thing that you want to do when you're starting any kind of job search, whether you are going for the first job or changing jobs or returning to the workforce, is you really have to do some hardcore self-evaluation. Take a look at yourself and say, well, where do I want to be? Where am I going? What am I good at? What do I have to offer? Because that's really what your employers are going to want to know about you. They want to know what value would you add to their organization. And I tell everybody to just start out with a brain dump. Take everything that you know about yourself and just throw it all on paper. It doesn't have to make sense. Just write down, here's all the things that I'm good at. Here are all the things that I really like to do. Here are the things that I really like to do, but I'm not so good at. And here are the things that I'm not good at, but I do enjoy. Here's the type of environment that I like to be in, and to kind of go from there and just put it all out there so that you can take a look at it, dissect it, and evaluate it. And then start asking around. Ask other people, well, what are my best attributes? What do you see in me? What do you think I contribute? How would you describe me? If I was on your team, what would you say? Or asking previous colleagues, you know, what would you say if you were giving me a testimonial, and collect that kind of information and just then kind of laying it all out. So that would be your P.
So in essence,
A. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, in essence, what you really want to do is not only look at yourself, but look at you through the eyes of others.
Absolutely. Look at yourself and find out also things that you may not know about yourself that others might know. And some tools that there are tools out there if you go to a career coach where you can do assessments that will pull that information out for you. So career assessments are a great tool to use when you're doing the personal inventory, and there are several out there that people use. There's the Myers-Briggs indicator. There's DISC, which is one of the ones that I enjoy using, the DISC profile, and that gives you a little bit more information as well, and gives you a little bit more of a profile for yourself, and you can read about yourself and kind of go from there as well.
One of the things that I noticed, which is very interesting, it was a young woman who now I'm not a resume expert, but there are things I can look at that, you know, through years of experience being in business, et cetera, that somebody might be looking for. And it was very interesting. I looked at the resume, and she was applying for just a normal, everyday kind of a job whereby she wasn't expected to have any management capability. She was just there, quote unquote, on the assembly line, so to speak. And I looked at the resume and had all of this experience as a manager here, as a supervisor here, and as a this there. And absolutely, if I was going to hire somebody for the assembly line, I wouldn't hire her because she was so overqualified. And so can you run into a problem that way?
Yes, because when you get to the point where you're ready to actually craft your resume, you have to also really know what is it that you're going for. And repackage yourself to kind of fit that. So if you are looking for a position that that would require less managerial experience or less supervisory experience, then that is not what you're going to play up. That's information that you may push down into the resume, and you might pull up things such as work, your teamwork, that you're able to work with the team, or that your organizational skills, or things along those lines that might be more task-oriented if you're looking for a position that's really more of a doer than a leader. So you really can tailor your resume depending on what it is that you're focusing on.
Okay, so in essence, when you go in, well, you in the general sense of the word, Michelle, there's a strategy to go in with. There's tactics to use, because if you don't use these tactics, somebody else will, and that's going to put you, quote unquote, out in the street with those 10,000 other people that are applying for the same job.
Absolutely. The trick is that it is so competitive that you need to find what makes you unique, and that's what you need to showcase. So if you're applying for a position and you put together a resume, but that resume really could be cut and paste and somebody else could use it, then what differentiates you from the next person or from the other 50 people that are in that pile? You need to find what's what what's really unique about you and make sure that that's right there in the profile.
There's a prime example of that, and I've used it time and again. It just brings the point home. You want to do a project at home. You want a hole in the wall. So you go to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. And I've asked time and again, are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? And many people will say, I'm buying the drill. The drill is not what you're buying. You're buying what the drill can do for you, which happens to be the hole. And the key here is this. Those people who are applying for the job, they're making the presentation. They're selling the drill. And what you're saying is sell what the drill can do, and that's going to put you above the crowd, and it's going to distinguish you and also give you what's called your value proposition.
Yes. When you say that, let's say in a resume, people use a lot of cliches such as team-oriented, just for one off the top of my head. Well,
sure.
Great. You're applying for a position. This position is definitely going to be part of a team. It's great that you're team-oriented, but so is 100 other people. What did you do that impacted a team? What did you do that added value to a previous team that you were on? And those are the things that you want to show, because the best indicator of how you're going to do in the future or for a future employer is what you've already done. And if you've already been successful in something, then that's what you want to showcase, because that's what an employer will take a look at and say, wow, that person did this in their previous position. Well, now they can come and do it for me.
Okay, and then let's say this again, that the team is the drill, and what you did
exactly
for that team is the unique proposition, the unique value, and that's the difference. So we're talking about which goes beyond a benefit. It's the perceived value of the person that you're dealing with. So what we're really talking about is what you can do, what the team meant, and what you could do for the team, not the team. You keep talking about the team. Everybody else talks about the team. You've wasted your time. They're going to say thank you, goodbye.
Exactly.
Now, training that ensures career advancement. Most people have no idea that there's training out there, that there's coaching out there. They've looked for jobs, and that's all they know, look for a job. But there are people like yourself that we can come to say, this is what I want, quote unquote, hold me by the hand and show me how to do it.
Right. And that actually comes to the next letter, which is A, assessing what you need. What is it that you need? Are you rusty? How long has it been since you've actually interviewed? And do you need somebody to coach you through the interviewing process? Do you need somebody to really go through with you how to conduct a job search? Do you have the most updated skills? And if you don't, then how do you go about and get them? So what I always recommend is that when you're looking at jobs and when you're looking at job advertisements, take a look and see what they're asking for. And if you don't have what they're asking for and you see a pattern that, you know, I'm interested in getting a position as, you know, an X, and as I'm looking through all of these jobs for X's, well, they want me to have a certain kind of computer skill, or they want me to have a certain kind of experience, then I need to go out and get that. And there are many different resources out there that you can go to, career coaches that can help you find those resources, whether it's continuing education courses or local community centers or support groups. There are plenty of places that if you reach out, you can find that either the information or the actual training and coursework that you might need in order to, you know, so to speak, fill in your toolbox of things that you might be missing.
I would probably be a nightmare to somebody like you. Can you imagine this first question? You would say, when was the last time you interviewed for a job? Now, I'm going to tell you, but you got to promise to keep it between you and I.
Only us.
Oh, phew. Okay, you had me worried. Do you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about that. It's been almost 50 years since I've applied for a job.
And there are a lot of people in today's job market that, unfortunately, because of where we are with this very difficult job market, people that have been in a position for 30 years and now they find themselves in a position where they need to go out and interview. And it is not the same game as it was 30 years ago.
No, and by the way, if anybody asked
10 years ago.
Yeah, when we had this conversation, that was like 15 years before I was born.
Right.
That I interviewed for the job. just so we have this level playing field here. But it's very true. I think that's an interesting point. Somebody has a job for 10, 15, 20 years. Now, all of a sudden, because of the economy, that place doesn't exist anymore, and he or she has got to go out now and apply. It's got to be scary for them.
It is. It's a scary place to be, and a lot of people get paralyzed by it. So they don't really know. It's not only that they don't have what they need in order to go out. They don't even know what it is that they do need. People get really stuck and really paralyzed.
Michelle, we're starting to run out of time, so let me ask you this. Website where we can find you, how do we find out about the coaching, and more important, how do we find out how to get a job?
Okay. You can come to my website at www.RicklandResources, that's RICLAN, resources.com. And I have many, many services for job searching, career counseling, interview training, resume writing. And I also have a book, that 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career, that comes with some really, really cool bonuses that assist in the job search as well.
Wonderful. Hey, Michelle, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. And a love who's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
A girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Susan Ashbrook with us, the author of Will Work for Shoes, the business behind red carpet product placement. She's been involved in celebrity product placement for 20 years now. She founded and pioneered Film Fashion, the first fashion producer placement company in Los Angeles. Her first client was Ralph Lauren, and she went on to match top celebrities with a roster of clients, and they just don't stop. Let's say, Susan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You know why I didn't want to mention all the clients? Because, Susan, I'm going to fall over some of the names because I couldn't say Isaac Mizrahi. It'd be in trouble.
And you did so, very well there. I think that Swarovski crystal is a tongue twister, though.
Yeah, that one, I wouldn't even try it. Okay. By the way, and you've worked with so many people. When we talk about red carpet product placement, give us a basic idea. What are we talking about? I have the book in my hands, by the way, and it's a keeper. It's going on the living room, whatever that is, the table, coffee table.
Oh, good, Michael. I'm glad to hear it. Well, red carpet product placement is, as you would imagine, there are award shows in New York and L.A. pretty much every weekend with award shows and movie premieres and charity events. And my light bulb went off, basically, when I realized that celebrities walking on that red carpet are a walking advertisement for brands, from the dress, the shoes, the handbag, the jewelry. Now it's even gone so far as the hair and makeup.
Now, by the way, and it really flies, and the other side of that is that we see the stars wearing these things. It's a great model for people to find those that are knockoffs of those particular products. So they really set the trend.
They really do, and I think the reason is that movie stars and Hollywood stars have always been like that over the years, because women, especially women, look at movie stars and say, gee, I could wear that too, whereas the fashion magazines, I mean, how many women are 6 feet tall and 100 pounds? You know, not so many. But movie stars, we do try and emulate what they look like and where they eat and their diet and their haircut. Quite a few things.
Now, by the way, what started you with this? What was that trigger, that light bulb that went on for you that said, this is my world, this is my work?
Well, you know, it's a great story for me. I was representing a brand based out of Germany called Escada. And we had the opportunity to work with Kim Basinger the year she was nominated for an Oscar. And there was quite a bit of drama that went on in the dress that she picked out, which was basically that Escada sent their top seamstress to Los Angeles. I set her up in a hotel room. I rented a sewing machine. And every day she worked with Kim to design and make Kim's beautiful dress. And it just so happened that Kim won an Oscar that year. And the great thing, and the light bulb that went out off for me, Michael, was that every year after that, for the Oscars, we see pictures of Kim winning an Oscar. And Escada gets press even today, and that was some 20 years ago. But I really wrote the book because I wanted people, just everyday people that look at celebrities and have a product that they want to get in the hands of the celebrities, I wrote the book with simple steps that anyone can follow to make that happen.
Now, by the way, so effectively we're talking about people who can be very creative, but it's the bridge. The book is the bridge to get to that particular clientele that they didn't think they could get to before.
That's right. Hollywood can be pretty intimidating, but, you know, celebrities are just like you and me. They're real people. And, you know, when I get together with my girlfriends, I want to know what new product they're using, you know, all kinds of things that we share as girlfriends. Well, celebrities do that, too. They love to find out about new products, and they often share that information to thousands of fans. In fact, Kim Kardashian has 7 million Twitter fans. So if you're a Kim Kardashian favorite product, she's going to write about it and let her 7 million fans know about it.
You know, when you really come down to it, the people live vicariously through the characters that we see. I remember standing in front of a couple of women one day, and they were talking about their favorite soap opera, and they were talking about the people in the soap opera as if they were their next door neighbor. They were living what the drama was being played out with in the soap opera the day before. And people do that with their favorite actors and actresses. They become them. They vicariously live through them. And if they don't have any kind of a life of their own, they can live through the adventure of a Brad Pitt or a somebody. And to dress like them, to even look like them, is maybe their one way of being able to express that they have their own identity and they are somebody.
That's right. Well, you look at Jennifer Aniston and the success of Friends. Well, her haircut was also a big success. Millions of people, women, went and got their haircut so that they could look like Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah, no, absolutely, no question about it. And I really believe that You know, these people that we spend these hundreds and billions of dollars to see, to worship, to do all the things that we do. When we say set trends, they do a lot more than that. They affect how a lot of people live. And if I, as the general public, can dress like them, now all of a sudden I've got somebody to relate to. I've got acceptance and some form of identity that goes along with it. Now let's take it a step further. Let's say that I'm a creator and I see all of these creations going on with the clothes that they wear. And I say, I can do that. But no, you can't. Why can't I? Because I don't know how to get there. Somebody's already been there and I haven't got a name that people are going to recognize. So you're saying now, and I'm going to repeat it, that now it's possible that people can do this. People can actually set the style, set the trends, and sell it.
I think so, Michael. And over the years, I've had thousands of people that have learned what I do for a living ask me, well, gee, how does it start? What's the steps? How do you get your things to celebrities? Everything from the pitch letter, where they're telling the celebrity about their product, how they invented it, why they created it. Sometimes those pitch letters, I see them and they're 10 pages long, and I'm telling people, you know, in the book, one of the steps is keep it succinct and brief, because nobody wants to read 10 pages. As fascinating as it may be, you have to keep it down to one page. Another tip I give is that to make it like Christmas for the celebrity. You know, if your product, the theme of your product is pink, then you want to have a pink box, pink tissue paper that helps tell your story. So some of the tips are really very simple, but they help bring attention to your brand to a celebrity who gets, you know, let's face it, they get pitched hundreds of these things a week. So you want to make it interesting for them and fun.
Yeah, and I think behind all of it, each one is saying, I have a problem. And the problem is the best look that I can possibly have. And you're talking about, you know, the pitch letter, to make that pitch letter something that says, I have the best solution to the problem that you have, and it's different from everybody else's because. And I really believe in every year that I've spent out in the world that in life comes down to, and marketing comes down to, a solution to a problem. Because everything in life in and of itself has got to be a solution. If you're married, then your husband would be a solution. You say, you know, how can he be a solution? He's a solution because he fills you up. He's that, what would it be like if he wasn't there? And then you could also say, did you fall in love with him or did you fall in love with the way he made you feel? Probably the way he made you feel. And if 10 guys were standing in front of you, he would be the one to have that spark. Your house, your car, everything that you have is a solution to something. And that's what, even if you're a producer on a radio show, you're looking for when you get all of these letters across the desk saying, I want to be on. It's who's going to be the solution. What's the solution to a radio show? Well, you want a guest that's entertaining, that people like to listen to, and will cause people to come back because you've had those kind of guests. So, in essence, the pitch letter has to have some kind of a solution to the problem.
Right, exactly. And I think that when I did research to find if anybody else had written a book like mine, I didn't find it out there. So I went, okay, I think I've got a little niche here. I better start working on the book right away.
I've got the book in my hand and the picture of you on the back cover. You got that smile,
yeah,
saying, I found it. I found it. No, which is really
cool.
Well,
I did it for many, many years. In fact, the title of the book, Will Work for Shoes, is really, it relates to a story that I write about, which is there was a Chinese actress that was attending the Oscars. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, there I was at her hotel with a pair of shoes along with two other representatives from companies. And I thought, oh, my gosh, here I am working for shoes, and they're not even mine. You know, but it was fun. I have a lot of fun stories to share.
By the way, and that's truly what it is. It's your experience, but as I'm looking through you got some great pictures in the book. And one man in there, you got Will Smith in a T-shirt. Okay. But it's interesting. This also applies to men, doesn't it?
It does apply to men, although probably not as much. But for that particular image that you're relating to, I had been approached by really thousands of T-shirt brands over the years, but that particular one was kind of a rock and roll brand, and I really thought, you know, if I get excited about a brand, I think celebrities will too. And they did. I had Robert Downey Jr. wearing that T-shirt. It's Worn Free is the name of the brand. Johnny Depp wanted them. So a lot of times for me, I had to get really excited about the brand, and then I knew celebrities would too.
Now, by the way, with celebrities and in the brand, and when we talk about brand, are we talking about the style of the clothes that's branded based on who the creator of the clothes are? Are we close here?
For me, the brand really is like Ralph Lauren. That's a brand where when you say the name Ralph Lauren, you have an image in your mind, and that company, Ralph Lauren, has done such a great job of creating that brand. And you have, as a radio personality, you have an established brand because when people say your name, they know your show, they know what you stand for. So you've created a brand yourself.
No, sure. So where I was going with that was the new person on the block, the one that wants to open the door to a whole new career for them. It's how do you create the brand? How do you create a brand from scratch that's going to compete with those brands out there that if you said Coca-Cola, everybody has a picture of a bottle and a Coke or a Ralph Lauren. How do you do that? I think that's one of the hardest things that these kids starting out have got to be able to overcome.
Right. I think that's a great question. And you do create a brand over time. It's not something that happens overnight. I think it's something that, you know, you have to be able to tell someone what you do or what your product is in one paragraph. And if you can do that, you're on your way to starting a brand.
Now, by the way, one of the things that is incorporated now, I happen to look at your press release, which is true, the importance of internet and social media to spread the word. There was a time when that 6 degrees of separation, your word could get spread through a couple of hundred people. But if you do it right, the Twitter, the Facebook, the rest of them, I mean, you're dealing with millions of people, if you say it right and you do it right, that are going to know who you are.
Yes, that's true. When I first started in PR, gosh, I remember the days when we stood over a fax machine and sent out press releases. But that's no longer true anymore. And for me, I like to tell clients that they should try and work with celebrities that have big following, big Twitter, are involved with Facebook, because they, in fact, will become your messengers. So social media is very important.
Now, I noticed the Twitters. Who did I see the other day? It was, I forgot who it was. But anyway, she had like 2,900,000+ followers, and she was following like 6 people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I think I saw that too. But, you know, I think a good example is Ashton Kutcher, who is very involved on Twitter and a big social media advocate. So, you know, if you got your product in front of Ashton Kutcher, you might be on your way.
Oh, no question. And I really believe that not only if he has, pick a number, if he's got 2 million people following him, and if something showed up of yours on his site that he liked, look at the people with those people who have followers, you could be talking about a lot of people. And if you've got 1% of the action of all that, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. But, you know, you could even do it in your own town. And I do write about that in the book where, you know, okay, so, yeah, you want to get to a Hollywood celebrity, but you might want to just start locally first, which could be your tennis coach, it could be through journalists, it could be the mayor of the city. There are people that influence trends and write about trends and talk about trends. So that might be a good way to start, just on a small local level.
Realistically, I think realistically most people wouldn't even think about that. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. our website is SusanJAshbrook.com.
And by the way, do you work with people privately?
I do. I do consulting over the phone, and if I happen to be, I travel. So if I happen to be in their town, I love to get together and actually consult and help people with their products.
Wonderful, because that makes a difference, too. The book is one thing, but then that one-to-one personal touch, that means everything in the world to most people.
I love doing that. I love to help people because I really feel that the people that get excited about their product and find me, I can help them connect to a star.
Wonderful. Hey, Susan, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I've appreciated your time you spent with us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.
Fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, The Anatomy of Addiction, Recognizing the Triggers Standing in the Way of Recovery. Dr. Karen Kalehi was with us, and I hope I pronounced that right. Karen, first a parent, second a practitioner. She speaks to parents and organizations about the formation of addiction, the critical aspects of nature and nurture, and the resulting disconnection. And listen to the words, the resulting disconnection between emotions and behavior. Karen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Pretty close. It's Kalecki. Thank you.
Kalecki. Okay. I will never forget it again. Now, let's talk. Let's talk about addiction. When we deal with it, let's start out with, what is addiction?
Addiction is not having power or control over the use of drugs or alcohol, or sex, gambling, that sort of thing.
Okay, but what causes addiction? When I say what causes it, is it brain chemistry? Is it habit? Is it emotional destruction that allows you to hide within whatever it is, gambling to alcoholism? What actually start this addiction, this overactivity regarding something?
Well, actually, you kind of hit all the crucial points that cause addiction or bring addiction about, and that is the still out a bit on whether there is a genetic component to addiction. We do know that addiction does tend to run in families, but again, it's not certain whether there's a gene that contributes to that or whether that is something that's a learned behavior. Many times you'll have multiple components that have kind of created this perfect storm that leads to addiction, and that is there can be problems in biochemistry. One of the most frequent issues or connections that we find are people who are bipolar. So we know that they have a different sort of a brain chemistry that leads them to self-medicate in order to deal with that brain chemistry that's gone awry. So there's that component to it as well. People also tend to soothe their emotional pain or discomfort with using drugs or alcohol.
Okay, but are we talking about, you know, a lot more dopamine than most people could even deal with? That's that feel good. That feel good chemical that gets shot out when you see something you like, or if you're going to get addicted to alcohol, etc. Is there any way to stop these things? And when I say stop these things, there's got to be a disconnect somewhere that causes the chemistry to happen this way. Is there any way that we can create the balance, that neurological balance in the brain that will allow somebody to be able to move through some of these traumas and challenges that they have?
Yes, I think there are, but I think you go back to the initial onset of addiction, and I see it starting to develop in children when they start to look for something to soothe their anxiety, look to soothe their stress and deal with areas of discomfort in their life. It really begins and forms at a very early age, and then you see people move through life. So unfortunately, there's not something quite as easy as saying we're gonna increase the dopamine in a natural way that will allow them not to seek that soothing from a chemical.
Okay.
It does happen that when people have a soothing reaction to a parent soothing a child who is stressed, they naturally release that dopamine that allows them to feel better.
Now, one of the things that I recognized years ago, I have done a tremendous amount of interviews over the years as regards to alcoholism. And everybody who I have interviewed has basically said the same thing. They're never not an alcoholic. They could be a recovering alcoholic. And what I found that they've done is they've transitioned that addiction to something positive. You know, I'm addicted to doing radio, so I'm going to do everything I can to sit down behind a microphone. But can't
Right.
you put it in a different direction?
You can. It takes learning to connect those dots. It takes learning to utilize that part of your intellect, your emotion, and trigger it in the right direction. When they go through recovery, they are able to replace behaviors and substitute ones that are more healthy. So some people connect with a spirituality. Some people connect with a form of relaxation through exercise and meditation, through art therapy, through working in an area that's passionate for them. For you, it's radio. For somebody else, it may be an artistic form. It may be getting back involved in a business venture that they had let go for a while they were actively involved in their alcoholism.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I'm listening very closely to you, and I made a note because I want to make sure that I've got this. Wouldn't it be phenomenal if, when a woman gets pregnant, or let's say even before that, let's say when somebody takes out a license to get married, there's a class to go to, and the class to go to would be how to have children and how to eliminate addiction before it even happens. Wouldn't that be interesting? And look at the hundreds of billions of dollars that would be saved every year in the medical facilities and with the therapists and everything else if the moms and dads would know what to do before it happened.
I think that's a phenomenal idea. One of the talks that I have given at school, I have four children, 21, 20, 17, and 12. And one of the talks that I've given since my 21-year-old was in kindergarten was I have spoken with parent groups, and the age group that I love to speak to, the parents of that group, are preschoolers and kindergartners. And one of the things that I talk to them about is I want you to take a look at the messages that are around us in our culture that promote youth in TV, billboards, print media. Take a look at even the shows that our children watch and the ads that they are viewing at that point in time, and take that into consideration. And then I want you to know that your child has radar, and they hear everything that you say. So when you say, you know, it's been a rough week, I really need a drink, or let's celebrate, let's go have drinks. Is every dinner party that you give, is there alcohol present? Is your way to celebrate and soothe through the use of alcohol? And your child is incorporating that message even from a very young age. They take that message in. So the message is you soothe and you celebrate through the use of substance.
Sure.
That's the message that they then take with them.
And messages obviously model, and these are coming through areas that the parents aren't even realizing that's going on. And let me tell you why I believe what you're doing will absolutely work, because if you reverse what you're talking about, look at the disaster that we've seen with the video games today, you know, the carjack, go shoot a cop, do this, do that, whatever. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, there were the Doris Day movies, and when they had any kind of sexual activity, or not, they didn't have that, any type of bedroom activity, there was a law. And the law at that time said you had to have 1 foot on the floor. Those were a completely different world. And what these kids see today, you can't stop it.
Right. There's that societal modeling that does go on. There's also parental modeling that goes on. And so I believe that if when people become aware of that issue and become sensitive to it and start changing what the message is, don't start every dinner party with wine or a blender, you know, let them know that socialization can occur without alcohol and drugs. Let them know that they can soothe frustration and stress without alcohol present. And teach them that that can happen, they're really able to incorporate a new message. And I believe that once parents understand that connection, they're able to alter their behavior and help their child grow up in a way in which they're not going to be prone to pick up alcohol or drugs in order to soothe emotional discomfort.
Sure. And one of the things in your press release, and even in your bio, the critical aspects of nature and nurture. Somebody said on the air some years back, it stayed with me because it left an impact. You know, why are women so much more emotionally giving than men are, for the most part? Obviously, there's a lot of men who are emotionally giving too. But why women more than men? And the answer to that, she said, was very simple. The answer to that was the women had more lap time. L-A-P, lap time, than the boys did. The little girls were held in mom's lap, and they were coddled, and they were loved. And the little boys, well, you didn't do that to them. And that's the one thing that was lacking. And because of that, there has been this, you know, there's a little bit of an emotional block, this wall between men and women and understanding. That has to be started, you know, very young with those kids to eliminate it before it happens.
Exactly. And that's very true. I think the increased awareness, what we see every day is we see people who have given up hope that they can be helped. We've seen families that have given up hope that their loved one can be helped. And they're really able. People do have an infinite ability to change. They can learn new behaviors. They can learn new patterns. And we really are receptive to those messages. We just need to get them out there. So when people understand that little boys need lap time just like little girls do, and that we are helping them by doing that, I believe that people will make some alteration in how they hold and nurture each other.
No, absolutely. And by the way, I am been accused of never being sensitive, which I probably not. I'm old school. If I had my choice for president and vice president today, it would probably be John Wayne and the Fonz. Okay, that said, you know what I'm like. And I'm an old Marine. Okay, so all of that said. But at the same time, there has got to be that understanding, because if you're not getting it at home, if you're not getting nurtured at home, if you're not getting any of it at home, you're going to go out and look for it somewhere else. And that somewhere else may not be the most positive, healthy, constructive place in the world to get it. We're going to do anything we can to create attention, which gives us identity.
Okay. I believe that's probably true.
Yeah, so why not have it at home?
People naturally want to feel okay. They naturally will seek to create a feeling within themselves where they feel okay. That's where we see people use drugs and alcohol to soothe feelings such as anxiety or stress, to deal with trauma or emotional upset, where they will use drugs or alcohol in order to try and mellow themselves out, so to speak. That's where they get to that slippery slope, is when they go to that as a way in which to soothe themselves.
Let me ask you the big question here. Here's the big one, okay? In your press release, it says, when addicts enter conventional is the operative word here. When addicts enter the conventional treatment programs, their relapse rate is about 70%. What do you do to offset that?
You help them to make the connection between emotions and behavior. And maybe that behavior that we're talking about initially is using. So if they feel anxiety, they feel stress, they feel anger, depression, resentment, if what they do, if the behavior that they relate to that feeling is to use, we want to help them make that connection. We want to help them understand and connect the dots between the behavior and the emotion. Once that connection has been made, what we start to do is show them how that has played out in their life and how it has changed the course of their life, in loss of job, loss of family, loss of social contact, loss of husbands and wives and children. So we're able to show them how those connections happen by connecting those dots. And then they create a groove in the road where they can go back and readily see, when they get to that place of anger and anxiety, that this is the slippery slope they're headed to. The way in which you help them to prevent that is help them to understand that that's what's occurred, and help them to learn a new way of dealing with that anxiety, stress, depression, frustration, whatever it may be.
So it's the emotion then that drives the behavior. And whatever their experience is that helped them model that emotion, that would dictate what their behavior is. So if you could change the impact of the experience, change the definition of the experience, it would neutralize the emotion, which obviously would be easier to get rid of the behavior.
Exactly. And understand that. Work it through. If there's been a trauma, a conflict, something that has created a wound, an internal emotional wound, whatever that may be, and for some, one person's ceiling is another person's floor, so you can't say that this is a bigger wound or that's a bigger wound. It's an interpersonal experience. So you help them to deal with that, heal that part, and be able to move on. Now, it is the case that for some people there is a biochemical issue going on, and that needs to be diagnosed. That needs to be understood. So if they are bipolar, if they do have high levels of anxiety, then you need to work those issues through. It may be that medication is needed to help deal with, it's definitely the case in with someone who's bipolar, that they need to have medication in order to deal with their biochemistry. So it's not just dealing with the emotional issues, but they need to be appropriately diagnosed. One of the things that we find at Creative Care is that people come in and they really haven't been understood. The most common comment we receive is, we never really understood what was going on. We never really got it. We never really understood why we're going through what we're going through. So appropriate evaluation and diagnosis is the key. And once we know what we're dealing with, whether it's a biochemistry issue and medication is indicated, or whether it's emotional trauma and pain, and then we know where to go with it and how to help that person heal.
Karen, we're starting to run out of time, but isn't ADD a good example of what you're talking about, ADHD? You know, you can have a misdiagnosis and be, treat the wrong thing, or you can look at it and not realize what it is in the first place, and you never get anywhere.
Exactly. Exactly. And in some kids, that you have to the beauty of where we're at today is that we understand that people can be helped, that they have an infinite ability to change and grow, and that there are people out there who are ready to help them. We also have today more and more knowledge about brain chemistry, dynamics, diagnosis than we ever did before. So we can understand whether someone is ADHD or ADD and how we need to help them. For some kids, an earlier intervention indicates that they can deal with learning in a different way, in a tailored environment, and they don't need the medication. For some kids, medication is indicated, and it will help them to avoid self-medicating later in life.
Wonderful. Karen, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
You can find us at creativecaremalibu.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Karen, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate what you're saying, and maybe someday they might start teaching this ahead of time and anticipate the problems before they actually happen.
That's our goal. Thank you for having me.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
And he shows them pearly white, just a jackknife has old McAhee's day. And he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with its teeth, baby, scarlet below stop to spread. But fancy gloves, though, where's old McAhee? So there's never a trace of red. I let that thing swing on the sidewalk. Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat coming down by the river, don't you know? Well, cement bags just hanging on down. Oh, that cement is there strictly for the white deer. Finally, get you 10 old Mackies back in town. Hey, hey, about Louis Miller. He done disappeared, dear. After drawing out, feels good. All his hard-earned cash. And now McAhee spends just like a shader. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Come on, come on. Then he died a ho, ho, ho. Shooky tawdry. Hello, Miss Lottie Linya. Good evening, Lucy Brown. And now that Mackie's back in old L.A. town. I said, Jenny, dive, look out, Suki Tawdry. Stay back, Lottie Linya. Move it over, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right, babe. And now that Mackie.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Robin Odegaard with us. She's the author of Stop the Drama, The Ultimate Guide to Female Teams. And she believes that we are, in fact, what she says, So a reality TV mirrors, and it's a disturbing trend in young women from high school age to the 30s, end up on using drama queen communication tactics to get what they want because they don't know any better. She's the founder of Stop the Drama Campaign, which helps young women deal with problems and issues without resorting to gossip, cattiness, or grudges. Rob and I, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Yes, I do believe we're in a communication crisis in the United States, and it's time we do something about it.
Oh, what a job you have. I believe that because when I say that is that you watch television. You watch the different soap operas. You watch The View and all of this and all the different news media. It is. It's drama. It's gossip. It's all of those things that are bringing us to a place where I don't even like to see anymore.
Right, and when I started working with high school and college age teams, I started seeing this trend over and over and over, and that's what kind of spurred me into, we have to do something. We have to give them a better skill set because they can't be successful in the workplace doing this.
Now, Robin, when it comes down to it, is when we talk about, and this is a question, no, I'm not a clinician, when we talk about the gossip and the rest of it, isn't this another way of pointing a finger at someone and saying, this is you and this can't be me? And the way we do it, we hide our own frailties or our own disappointments in ourselves by throwing it on someone else.
Well, that's one way to look at it. The way that I explain it when I speak is that it's about owning your own power, owning what belongs to you and letting other people own what belongs to them. And unfortunately, so often, so many of us do the opposite. We try to own other people's stuff, and we push our stuff on other people.
Yeah, and by the way, I saw something interesting when you talk about, you know, from reality TV to school halls and team sports, we're teaching the young ones to deal with disagreement by using gossip, backstabbing, screaming, fighting, and throwing drinks, and the list goes on. But when it really mm-hmm. comes down to it, there is an element of violence that we have today that we did not have 10, 15, 20 years ago. There was always some violence, there's no question, but it's peaked. And I watched time and again on television where a couple of young girls, 14, 15 years old, are duking it out like the guys used to do, and there's blood all over the place. There's no difference anymore. If this means equality, then somebody should step back and say, you know, kids, let's relook at our lives here.
Right. We have women that are getting into fistfights, and when I speak, I also have people saying, oh, but men use gossip and drama too. Absolutely, they do. And so nobody's got healthy skills, and that's what I'm trying to fix with, like, the 7 no-fail secrets to stop the drama and the 9 secrets to great teamwork, which are available for free downloads on my website, stopthedramanow.com. I'm trying to provide parents, teachers, coaches, administrators with something else they can use to help kids be more successful to communicate disagreements and conflict.
Now, by the way, I when you just gave out the website, etc., do it a little slower.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, stopthedramanow.com.
Okay, stopthedramanow.com. Great. Now, because mm-hmm. I don't want anybody to miss that. I think it's extremely important. And the other thing is when we say, you know, men do it too, guys do it too. Absolutely. But just for somebody to say, well, the men do it too, let's say, well, then it's okay if you do it. And I believe totally in what you're saying. Take responsibility for your actions. You can't stop somebody from walking up and smacking you in the nose, but you can control how you feel about it and dealing with yourself with whatever that means to you. And I think it's extremely important to be able to accept responsibility of your own actions.
Right, and if we give them the language to be able to articulate that, they don't have to resort to these negative behaviors.
No, oh, by the way, and you're right. And the negative behaviors today can get somebody hurt and or killed. And I think, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that, and that's not necessarily drama. That's reality. When I was a kid, I don't remember anybody who carried a gun off campus or whatever the case may be. Nobody thought of anybody being shot. We live in that mm-hmm. culture today. And if somebody hasn't got controlled emotions, who knows what they can end up doing? So I think you're spot on out there.
Right, and I really hope that this book, that's my goal. I'm so passionate about this, and I want the book and the campaign and my speaking to really make a difference, to make a positive impact on people's lives and allow them to be more successful in their lives. I don't want people to struggle when they get to the workforce like I did.
No, by the way, when you said struggle getting to the workforce, did you come up against the gossipers and the backstabbers and the talk behind your back?
Exactly. I spent 14 years working in the corporate world, and I had a lot of experience with people being gossipy and backstabbing. But additionally, on top of that, my yearly reviews said things like tactless, can't communicate, not a good manager, and I couldn't find anybody to help me with that. And that's what I'm trying to fill.
Okay. Now, by the way, are you getting a bunch of feedback?
I'm getting an echo. Yes.
Okay. Let me see if we can adjust that. We'll have Seth, who's working the board over there, the engineer, who is magic when it comes to that stuff, and I'm sure he heard it and he's working on it. Okay. So what it really comes down to it, it's again taking responsibility for yourself, and also you said it in the workplace, and all of those reports that they got about you and the et cetera, was not necessarily about you. It's about someone who felt threatened by you, and because of feeling threatened, they struck back in that manner.
That's definitely one possibility. The other possibility is I just didn't have the communication skills to articulate myself successfully. And I can tell you that's the truth. I'll tell you a real story. I was managing people, and I actually said to people one time, I need you guys to be more effective because my bonus is tied to you getting this work done. That's not very motivating. It's not very helpful.
Okay. Now, so how do you motivate? How would you have turned it around as the Robin you are today?
Well, the more important thing now that I understand today is being able to give people their own power and to give them a reason. So assuming the positive, I know that we can be more successful, and let's figure out how we can do this together. So it's about us. A positive situation rather than you need to fix this to make it better for me.
Okay, so it's collaborative then.
It's collaborative. The skills I teach are all about taking what goes on in your head, which I call your internal dialogue. Whenever you have a conversation with somebody, there's a whole bunch of feelings and ideas and concepts going on in your head, your internal dialogue, that we never share with the other person, but yet we make assumptions that they know what's going on, and we say things based on those assumptions, being able to put that internal dialogue into words and explain it to other people.
Okay, moms and daughters. I mean, really, that's where it starts to model. Mom models, and the daughter, until she learns, is going to do whatever it is that she's been taught to do, and it's all unconscious at the time. But there's five successful skills that you talk about that you're failing to give your daughter. You don't have to do all five. But what are one or two of the things that we could look at that moms and or dads are not giving the daughter?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that we don't do successfully as parents is set expectations the way that we should. We expect our kids to be able to do certain things, but we never actually say to them specifically, this is what I need from you. And you can't hold somebody accountable to something you've never actually told them, but we do that. And I think if we could model expectation setting more successfully, that would be really great for our daughters.
Okay, that's an important word. The operative word there is expectation setting. If you don't have a goal, if you don't have an end result for what you are saying, it doesn't really go anywhere. And there's no concrete, there's no hard stop that you can evaluate what it is that you did, why you did it, how you did it, and what the end result is. And now, let's go to three easy ways to handle your family drama over the holiday and into the new year, because it's coming. At least one kind of a tip that people can walk into the holidays with.
Oh, this is a great tip for the holidays. I'm sure that you sat at family dinner and the conversation escalates and somebody says, you make me so fill in the blank, angry, furious, other words we don't say on radios. And that is one of the things you should just, that's not helpful. It escalates the situation, not de-escalate it. So rather than, you make me, it's much better if you can say something like, I'm becoming very frustrated. What can we do about that? That opens the dialogue.
Okay, now, there's a lot of people who won't stop at that. They're going to have, and it's not even the other person that they're yelling at. What I have found over the years, Robin, the people end up yelling at themselves. And and that person out there is nothing more than a mirror.
Right, right. So then I think the best opportunity at that point is to make them feel heard. It's been my experience that people will continue to berate and carry on because they don't feel heard. And if you can say, what I'm hearing you say is, you're upset about, or let me make sure I'm clear, and kind of mirror it back to them, it'll make them feel heard, and then that'll help them calm down.
Okay. Now, by the way, I want to jump into something else because I just noticed something on your press release, which I think is extremely important. And I would say this time and again to so many people who have been on the air, that you need to take the skills that you're teaching and put it in the schools. I know that there's a challenge and there's blocks, et cetera, but executive coaching is a $2 billion a year industry. And if these skills, if they're so valuable, why aren't they being taught in schools? I think that's that is a fair question.
Well, and that's why I do speak at high schools, colleges, universities, and corporate events. But I speak to students because I'm passionate about these skills need to be taught before they're 25 or 30 years into their corporate career. They need them when they enter. And if I can even give them one skill, if I get a 20-year-old and I get them one skill that they can use once a day for the next 50 years, I'll make a difference in more than 18,000 conversations in their life. And to that, for me, that's huge. That's passion.
Big time. And by the way, women, from the mean girl to the motivating women, how women can work better together. I have said for years, and I'm still of this mindset, I would not want to be working with five women and me the only guy in there.
Right. I don't know if you know about this. There's a study that was done with sea crabs. And if you put male sea crabs in a jar, they help each other out. If you put female sea crabs in a jar, they pull each other back into the jar and they all starve to death.
Mm. And by the way,
you know, I feel like...
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Finish the thought.
I was going to say, I feel like as humans, we should have more ability, cognitive ability than sea crabs. I'd like to think we could help each other out of the jar, and that's what I'm trying to teach is how we do that.
Okay, now, how do you get somebody to take that step? Somebody is used to being a certain way all their lives, and how do you get them to take that step?
Well, when I work with teams, the first thing I do is I talk to everybody about what I call their individual communication fingerprint. How have they been taught to communicate? What do words mean to them? And when people start to realize that everyone has an individual communication fingerprint, it's amazing the light bulb you see go on. And then in teams, you can develop what's called a team communication fingerprint, where they learn as a team to all communicate the same way.
Yeah, because just because you say a word does not necessarily mean that person that you've said it to is going to hear it in the way that you meant it. If I were to say to you, chamber around, you know what that means?
No, I don't know what that means.
Okay, and that's fair enough. You haven't been exposed to it, so you're not going to have an image for it. But if I said to you, put a bullet in a gun, you're going to see a bullet in a gun now, right?
Right, absolutely.
See now we're speaking a language that you recognize, and I think there's where the problem lies in communication. Because we say it doesn't mean the other person has heard it in the way that we meant it. Every word we speak has a corresponding mental image. And it has a picture, and it goes to that unconscious mind. If you've never had the word, you don't have the image. And if you're speaking to somebody that doesn't have the image of what you're saying, it's like speaking Russian to a Chinese audience.
Right, exactly. And another problem is that maybe you say a word I have been exposed to, and it means something different than it does to you.
Sure.
So listening is different than hearing, and hearing is different than understanding.
No question. No, absolutely not. And I think more and more businesses or teams that would understand that, the world could totally and completely change. Robin, we're starting to run out of time now. Website, please, that we can find you at.
Absolutely. They can come to stopthedramanow.com. And like I said, there's some free downloads there. that they can get, and they can learn about my book, Stop the Drama Now, The Ultimate Guide to Female Teams. I would also love for them to join me on Facebook at the Stop the Drama campaign. That would be wonderful.
Wonderful. Hey, Robin, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it so much. Have a good night.
You too. Good night.
Just a jackknife that has old mega heaps of space, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with its teeth, baby, scarlet below start to spread. But fancy gloves, though, wears old mega heaps, baby, so there's never, never a trace of red. I let them then swing on a sidewalk. Sunday morning, don't you know? Lies a body.